Well, welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the law and politics podcast with me, Ken McDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen.
Well, you may have noticed we don't have any intro music this week. Instead, Tim and I wanted to start this episode of Double Jeopardy with a tribute to Isabella Forshall, King's Counsel, following the devastating news that she died suddenly and unexpectedly last Tuesday in Argentina, where she was on holiday with her husband, Tim, and her son, Arthur. Izzy was a stellar and much-loved member of the criminal bar, where she'd practised for over 40 years. One of the founders of Doughty Street Chambers, she was funny, waspish, clever, loyal, completely untouched by pomposity or self-regard, and a wonderfully calm, direct and compelling advocate whose informal style never concealed her underlying steel. Izzy was a brave person. She was never intimidated by rank pulling or by the use of status, but she could be blunt, even fierce in the face of them. But she never punched down. She was true. For my part, I remember how you'd reluctantly turn up to some dreary legal reception you're obliged to go to, and then you'd spy Izzy chatting away in the corner, and you'd think, thank God for that, it's not going to be so dreary after all, and you'd head straight over to her, and it would just be a delight. It was never anything other than pure pleasure to be with her. Tim and I knew Izzy, and indeed have known her husband Tim over many decades. She'll be terribly missed by her friends and by the wider criminal law world. She was the loveliest of people, and as the leader of the Southeastern Circuit wrote on hearing of her death, she was the best of us.
Yes, absolutely, Ken. As you say, Izzy was a founder member of Doughty Street Chambers, where I spent five very happy years during the 1990s before leaving to set up Matrix with you and others. I can say, I'm sure, without any contradiction, that Izzy was the most popular member of Doughty Street. She was loved by members and by staff, and admired for her extraordinary character and, as you say, her steeliness as a wonderful criminal defence lawyer. And she will be hugely missed, as you say. And we send our condolences and sympathy to Tim, to Arthur and to Mary.
Well, with that all said, we'll now turn to this week's episode, which I think is going to be a really fascinating one, because we are fortunate enough to have with us Aqua Reindorf, King's Counsel. And we're going to be discussing the vexed issues of free speech in universities and the new Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act. How will this help? Will it help? Might it not help? Aqua specialises in employment discrimination and human rights law, focusing on complex litigation and high-profile internal investigations. And she has a particular expertise in the higher education sector. Her work has included the very well-known Reindorf report, which she prepared for the University of Essex, into alleged no-platforming of two external speakers who were accused of transphobia. Her report was hailed as a turning point in the debate on sex and gender, trans rights and cancel culture in universities, and we'll be discussing that report later. She's also conducted large-scale investigations for the University of Cambridge, the University of Oxford College, the University of Warwick and many others. Her recent claimant work includes representing James Essie's trainee psychotherapy in his case against his training institution, challenging his summary expulsion from an MSc course after he lodged a public petition calling on the government to safeguard evidence-based therapy for children with gender dysphoria. He was kicked off a course for that. I'm very interested to explore that case with you a little later. She also, along with Karen Moynihan, King's Counsel, who has appeared on this podcast, defended the LGB Alliance against the extraordinary challenge brought to its charitable status by Mermaids, the trans advocacy group. I think most people think that that was a case which blew up in Mermaids' face, and by the end of it, most people were asking the question as to whether Mermaids should have charitable status. She also successfully, this is one I particularly like, she successfully represented cleaners employed at Topshop after they were dismissed for taking part in union protests over poverty pay. Very classy, Topshop. As a result of that case, one of her clients, a cleaner at the flagship Topshop branch, won £75,000 as a payout after being fired over a low-wage protest. Akra was appointed as a commissioner of the Equality and Human Rights Commission in 2021. She's been an employment judge since 2020. She was appointed King's Counsel in 2023. She's acclaimed in the directories as superb. She was awarded Employment Junior of the Year in the Chambers UK Bar Awards 2022. And she was one of the lawyers' Hot 100 for 2022. So that last one in particular, Akra, leaves you a lot to live up to in this podcast. I thought I'd finish with that one. Welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. Thank you, Ken.
Yeah, hi, Akra. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tim.
I thought we'd start with the Rheindorf report that you did for Essex University. And this was a report that you did after a couple of speakers were, as it's put, no platformed by, a department in the university and perhaps a student society. But could you, and you were asked to write a report into these events and to make recommendations. Could you just start off by describing, if you wouldn't mind, the background to this, how you got involved and what the issues were?
Yeah, sure, I will do. I was approached to do this piece of work just like any other piece of work. An email went round Chambers asking if anybody was available to do an investigation. And I put my hand up, not little knowing that it would end up in a complete transformation of my practice. And it was an investigation into two incidents that had happened at the University of Essex, which were, on the face of it, unconnected to each other. I had to be interviewed by the university for the job, and that was all fine. They were perfectly lovely. They offered me the brief and I took it, and I spent some time over the summer interviewing a number of people and then wrote up my report. It wasn't actually very difficult legally. It was very interesting in terms of the evidence, but from a legal perspective, it wasn't terribly complicated. It was about Professor Joe Phoenix, who is a criminology professor who was at that time with the Open University. And she had been due to speak at the University of Essex about the prison policy for women and trans women. And that was cancelled at the last minute because of protests and fears about safety. And then she was, a vote was taken within the department, the relevant department, to the effect that she should never be invited again. And then separately, Professor Rosa Friedman, who at that time was at Reading and still is at Reading University, Joe Phoenix is now at Reading University with her. Professor Rosa Friedman had been invited to speak a few weeks later in a totally separate event about the Holocaust Memorial Day, about anti-Semitism, which as a Jewish academic is a specialist subject and a personal subject for her. And there was, I found in my report, as you'll see, an attempt to prevent her from doing so, but in the end, it was reinstated. Her invitation was reinstated. And I was asked I was given a very free hand to investigate what had happened and what the relevant legal principles were and who was at fault, if anybody. When it was finally published, it was heavily redacted in terms of the fact. So there's not much more I can say about what findings of fact I made.
I was going to ask you about that because, as you say, I mean, I was reading through it the last couple of days, and about half of it is redacted, so inaccessible. I mean, is that a reflection of a sort of climate of fear that you encountered in terms of getting people to say anything to you, but it had to be done on terms of anonymity?
To be honest, Tim, I don't know. I wasn't involved in the redactions. That was all done by solicitors after the event, and I'm not sure what the reasoning was behind that. But as far as I know, it was to do with people's privacy.
Can we just drill down into these cases a little bit? And can we start with Dr. Professor Friedman's? I mean, she'd been invited to the University of Essex to speak at an event which was part of the Holocaust Memorial Week or Holocaust Memorial Month. And the event was centred on the Holocaust and certain aspects of it. And the reason that her invitation was rescinded was because some people objected to her views in an entirely different area. In other words, they objected to her gender critical views, and they felt that because of her gender critical views, she wasn't a fit person as a Jewish academic to come and speak at a Holocaust event.
Well, in summary, yes.
I mean, that's pretty obnoxious, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I've made my findings, Ken, you know. I mean,
yeah, you have.
Just to be clear, Rosa, I don't think would describe herself as gender critical, but certainly she described as such. No, I mean, but she was described as such, and she had signed a letter in The Guardian that had been signed by a number of academics sometime previously, which Joe Phoenix had also signed, which was regarded as being a gender critical letter. I mean, Rosa, I'm sure she wouldn't object to being described as having broadly gender critical views. So yes, that's what happened. Her invitation being rescinded was nothing to do with the subject that she was talking about.
Yeah. I mean, in your report, both in relation to Professor Friedman and Professor Phoenix, you, having gone through very exhaustively all the relevant law, domestic and ECHR, European Convention law, you reached the conclusion that the decision to cancel the seminars or the invitations were unlawful, amounted to breaches of the duty to sustain freedom of expression and so on. And you made, at the end, 28 recommendations. I'm just interested to know how many of them were enacted or by the University of Essex, because I note that after your report was published, the university issued an apology to transgender and non-binary staff and students over your review because of its timing and the stress and distress that the publication of the report had caused, which on the face of it is somewhat undermining of your findings.
Well, I mean, that wasn't one of my recommendations, I'll say that much. It, as I understood it, the apology was for things like the timing. It was on, I don't know, Trans Day of Remembrance or something of that sort. And there was Pride Month or something like that. I'm not sure. Again, I was completely out of the picture by that stage. The recommendations that I made included apologising to Professors Phoenix and Friedman, which was done. As I understand it, a number of other recommendations are in hand, although, as I say, I'm not involved in it anymore. The one most controversial recommendation I made was that the university should reconsider its relationship with Stonewall, which I'm sure we can talk about. But I just want to go back a moment, Tim, because you said that I found that the invitations being rescinded was unlawful. Actually, in respect of Joe Phoenix, I found that the actual cancellation of the event was necessary because there had been a threat, a really unpleasant, violent threat made in the moment. But what I found was that the subsequent blacklisting was unlawful.
Yeah, but I think you said that if there'd been better preparation and there should have been anticipation of the whole event, and if that had taken place, it wouldn't have been necessary to cancel the seminar.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Okay, so let's just pause and take breath and see where we are here. So this university, the University of Essex, had in the case of Professor Friedman, rescinded an invitation to her to speak at a Holocaust event because she had signed a letter to the Times, which was regarded as being gender critical. So far as Professor Phoenix was concerned, not only was her event cancelled or postponed because of a threat of violence and a threat by students that they would barricade the room, but the Department of Sociology later took a vote and voted to exclude Professor Phoenix from any future seminar. So this is not the students, this is the academics.
There were students as well.
Okay, students and academics voting to exclude Professor Joe Phoenix from any future event on the grounds of her views on trans issues.
Yes.
That's where we were when you were asked to report.
That's right.
Yeah. Can we just move on to Stonewall's influence? One of the most significant passages in your report, and I think it's one that got a lot of attention was your analysis of the university's analysis of the Equality Act. And one of the things the university claimed in its trans policy about the Equality Act was this. It said, under the Equality Act 2010, it's unlawful to discriminate against or treat someone unfairly because of their gender identity or trans status. Now, that is categorically untrue. The protected characteristic under the Equality Act is gender reassignment, which is a completely different thing. Now, this policy was reviewed repeatedly by Stonewall, and they never picked that up. I think you're quite generous to Stonewall in your report, if you don't mind me saying so, because you say this. This policy is founded on an erroneous understanding of the law. The policy is reviewed annually by Stonewall, and its incorrect summary of the law does not appear to have been picked up by them. In my view, the policy states the law as Stonewall would prefer it to be, rather than the law as it is. Now, that's clearly right. This is what Stonewall would have liked the Equality Act to say, but it didn't say that. And Stonewall must have noticed this when they were reviewing the policy. They must know what's in the Equality Act and what's not in the Equality Act, surely. So this can't just have been overlooked.
I mean, one can't be sure about that, to be perfectly honest. I've seen more recent material from Stonewall, which doesn't indicate to me that they've understood two really key things about the law. One is that gender identity is not the protected characteristic, although I think that that is perhaps conceded. But the other much more important issue that they haven't seemed to have understood is that discrimination because of gender reassignment doesn't necessarily encompass things like not being permitted to use single-sex facilities in the acquired gender or being misgendered or things of that sort. It's not automatically the case that if somebody is not treated as if they are the acquired gender, that they are being discriminated against. And that's a very key issue, which I haven't seen much evidence of Stonewall understanding in the 2 years that have passed.
You say that there's no evidence of them understanding it. Maybe the fact of the matter is they don't want to understand it.
Well, that may be true.
You quote at one point in the report the registrar of Essex University saying this, that as a university, we have been quite explicit that we want to be a values-driven institution rather than our approach being defined, conditioned, constrained by what the law requires of us. Now, I suppose one could read that in one of two ways. One could think, well, that's just a perfectly reasonable liberal approach by a university that doesn't want to be, as it says, simply limited by the law. Or it could be a statement by saying, well, we don't really care what the law says because our values, as we assert them, are the important thing, and therefore it could be seen as supporting what is, as I think you've pointed out, and as Ken has just said, is obviously a complete misstatement of the law by Stonewall-influenced equality and diversity policy.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that I found in a number of universities and other organisations, that there has been a tendency to go down this sort of values route, and alongside that, to make commitments to go beyond the law, not just to Stonewall, but to other accreditation schemes which exist in the higher education sector. And what isn't necessarily properly understood is that that the law is a very delicate ecosystem, and going beyond it in one direction can result in pulling away on the other side.
Just following up on that, again, asking you the impression you formed about the nature and scale of the problem at Essex. You quote at one point Richard Garside, who is the director of the Centre for Crime and Justice Studies, commenting about the cancellations of these two speakers. He said, appearing to capitulate to a handful of bullies and ideologues is not a good look. To which, you know, one says, yeah, quite right, it isn't a good look. But the question is it a handful? I mean, is this a case of a really tiny minority of sort of quasi-Maoist Red Guards bullying and threatening and intimidating the majority? Or is it a more widespread phenomenon?
Well, I mean, I'm not talking specifically about Essex now, but my broader experience of the university sector, which has been quite broad. I think there is a small handful of people who are very committed, and then there is a large swathe of people, mostly on the humanities and arts side, who are sort of vaguely committed, feel that it's important to be kind, what I would call the be kind people, and who are or who are frightened of speaking about it, don't want to speak about the matter at all. And then there's about 50% of people who are just bemused by the entire thing and don't want to put their toe in the water. But the minority, the activists, are a very small minority.
And we're talking here about transgender ideology and its impact on the ability to have open and robust conversations in universities, the extent to which some of those conversations appear to be closed down. I mean, and Stonewall had for a long time, didn't it, a no platform policy, in the sense that it wouldn't even publicly debate with people on the other side of the argument. In other words, that if you even tried to have a debate about this, this was somehow denying trans people's existence and was therefore morally impermissible. That was the sort of attitude.
Well, their strapline was no debate.
Yeah. It's a good opening, that, isn't it? No debate. It's a very good way to approach issues of controversy. And I mean, universities can't function like that. Do you feel there's a widespread problem across the university sector, Acra? I mean, some people say this is all got up by culture warriors, and some people say, you know, it's almost impossible now to speak freely in universities. I mean, I presume the truth is somewhere in the middle.
I think that there's a problem in the more affluent, middle class, dare I say, white universities. Well, actually, no, I'll take that back. The more affluent middle class universities, the top, you know, the Russell Group universities at Oxbridge, where identity politics is more salient. I think in the universities which are populated by the less affluent students, they have far fewer problems with it. I've worked in a university which is in a working class city, where they've had for the first time an issue with identity. It's not even identity politics. They've had an issue with anti-Semitism, and I've advised them on that. But they've never experienced any of the sex and gender debate problems or issues relating to that at all. And there are other universities similar. Whereas where it comes up again and again is Oxbridge, Edinburgh, Bristol, and so on.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because this is particularly perceived in the United States as an Ivy League issue. So Yale, Harvard, Stanford, these are the universities, the real elite universities, where it's more of a problem. But I just want to push back a bit, if you don't mind, Acra, because I worked in Oxford for 9 years between 2012 and 2021. And around about 2014, we began to hear about this sort of stuff in the States, and it began to kind of trickle over. And I'd say by 2017, 2018, identity politics had got a real grip on the students. But the number of actual incidents of no platforming, I mean, were very, very small. And they were bad when they happened. What happened to Selina Todd, the noted gender critical historian at the University of Oxford, when she was forbidden from speaking at a Women's Day event, was disgraceful. What happened to Amber Rudd was very unattractive, an invitation withdrawn at the last moment. But the truth is, although students in conversations spout a lot of identity politics, the philosophy behind which they don't really, I'm afraid, understand, so far as I can see, the actual instances of speech being shut down formally in that way are pretty small. It very rarely happens. Well, during my years, it very rarely happened, up until 2021.
Well, to your knowledge, it very rarely happened. I think what's very obvious to me is that there is a chilling effect. I mean, that's, to my mind, completely undeniable. I have encountered several people, when I've been doing formal investigations, who simply will not speak to me, because even to anonymously to an investigator, because they're afraid of retribution. That, to me, it's not everywhere. As I say, there are universities where it's not a big problem, but where it is a problem, there is a really significant chilling effect, and it's really quite oppressive for the academics who are involved in that.
Of course, in February 2021, I think your report was published round about then, wasn't it?
May. It was May 21.
May 20. But in February 2021, the government had published this white paper, I think it was, Higher Education, Free Speech and Academic Freedom. And amongst other things, it announced a proposal in that white paper for a new free speech and academic freedom champion. I mean, the foreword by the Secretary of State for Education, the then Secretary of State Gavin Williamson, is sort of hilarious on the basis you sort of know he couldn't possibly have written it because it's actually quite sort of historically interesting and literate. Ending with a quote from John Milton, "Let Milton's freedom ring out across our universities." Anyway, to what extent were you aware that that paper was in the pipeline? And obviously your report, published a few months after the white paper, would provide or did provide very strong sort of evidential support for the need to strengthen academic freedom, freedom of speech on university campuses.
Can I just say this government paper arose out of a Policy Exchange report that was co-authored by Dr. Tom Simpson, who's a fellow at the Blavatnik School of Government in Oxford. And he wrote a Policy Exchange paper which contained most of the proposals, which eventually ended up in the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act, which we'll probably talk about in a moment. But so I think this was two or three years in coming. There was a gestation period, wasn't there?
Yeah, I was aware of it. I mean, I wasn't particularly aware of it when I was finalising the report, not least because actually I finished the report in the December. It went through peer review and various revisions in the following 5 months, 4 months. So I had finished it before I'd heard of the white paper, but then I was very aware of it afterwards. And I know that they did have regard to my report when they were thinking about the bill.
So let's get on to the legislation, the Freedom of Speech, the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act, which received royal assent very recently. It went through the Lords. It had a bit of a bumpy ride in the Lords. I mean, it contains provisions which require, many provisions, but for relevance today, provisions which require universities and student unions to have regard to the importance of free speech, to have policies to protect free speech, and indeed not to discriminate against academic students visiting speakers on the grounds of their beliefs or opinions. In other words, you can't stop someone like Selena Todd speaking because she's a gender critical feminist. You can't not invite or you can't stop someone like Jo Fenech from speaking because she's a gender critical feminist. So it contains those provisions on the one hand. It contains a provision to require provisions to require the Office for Students to monitor free speech in the university. So, and it contains a provision to appoint a director of free speech and academic freedom who will report to the Office for Students. And very importantly, it contains, and this was particularly contentious in the House of Lords, it contains a new tort, allowing people to take universities or student unions to court if they are in breach of the provisions of the Act. So could you start by giving your overall view of this legislation? I mean, do you think it was necessary? And then perhaps we can go to some of the individual provisions. I mean, was this just a culture? Was this the government stirring up culture wars because it saw some political advantage in it? Or was it meeting a genuine problem?
I mean, whatever the motivations of government, I'm not privy to the minds of the Conservative Party or the government, whatever their motivations were, it's, I think, necessary as a piece of legislation. I'm afraid to say, I've had enough exposure to these issues, and not just in the sex and gender debate, but in relation to anti-Semitism, which is a very, very difficult and challenging area, and issues relating to racism, especially in the wake of Black Lives Matter in 2020. I've dealt with matters relating to all of these issues, and I think there is a problem that the Act seeks to address. Whether it's completely the right Act, whether it chooses exactly the right mechanism for enforcement is open to debate. We'll see how it works out, but I think something was needed. I think that the higher education sector is needs a shake.
I mean, there was already, and you go through it in your report on Essex University, already extensive legal provision and duties imposed on universities, higher education providers, as they are generally called, to protect and freedom of expression. As far as I can see, this new bill, the only real difference in terms of altering the current framework, one is that there's now an active duty to promote freedom of expression as opposed to simply defend it and query what the significance of that is. And then the other is, well, maybe three things. The other is to bring student unions within the legal duty specifically. And then thirdly is the statutory tort, to thereby enabling individuals, academics, speakers, and what the students to bring a civil claim both against the university and against the student unions insofar as they breach the various duties. I mean, is that a fair summary?
Well, there's also the complaints scheme.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And the free speech director, which I think is important. I mean, the existing duty under Section 43 of the Education Number 2 Act was a duty to, you know, secure freedom of speech for people, but it didn't have any obvious enforcement mechanism apart from judicial review, which, you know, nobody's going to take their university to judicial review. It's ridiculous. So it was a bit toothless, to be honest. It didn't extend to student unions, and it was difficult to implement. Yeah, and I think I'm glad to see student unions brought into it. I know it's controversial, and I know it's difficult for them to face the prospect of civil litigation. However, I think it is that the unions do need a kick up the backside in this respect.
Yeah.
And I think that the complaints scheme is a good idea. It will be free to take a complaint through the complaints scheme for an academic or for a member of the university. You won't be able to go to court until after you've exhausted the complaint. That's the most recent compromise that was made with the Lords on that provision. And then there'll be a simple tort. I would have personally preferred to see it incorporated into employment law somehow, rather than put into a separate civil tort to go before civil judges who aren't familiar necessarily with the wide range of issues that are in play. But it will in any event come into play in employment tribunal proceedings, I'm quite sure.
So, Aka, one of the things you say there is that universities need a kick up the arse. And I think this raises one of the issues that was of concern in the Lords, and that's the kind of issue of unintended consequences. So student unions are now involved. Student unions are occupied by student union officers who are in post for a year and then move on. They have no institutional memory. They're often, they can be run by people of varying maturity, to put it bluntly. They're often not terribly serious organisations. And one of the things that people are concerned about is that this great sort of panoply of structure and bureaucracy that the bill creates around free speech might actually have the opposite effect to that intended. It might have a chilling effect. People are going to be more worried about issuing invitations to controversial people, because if they do and there's pushback, they might find themselves liable in law, liable to the Office for Students, liable to internal complaints procedures, and finally liable to the tort. And the easiest way for universities and student unions to respond to all of this bureaucracy and structure is simply to have less controversial events, not to invite controversial speakers, not to run the risk of barricades and protests and no platforming. And that's a real worry, isn't it?
And before you answer that, Aka, can I just put to you what was said at the second reading of the bill in 2021 by Matt Weston? He's the Labour MP for Warwick and Leamington. It happens to be he's actually married to, his wife is a professor of history at Warwick University, so no doubt he's got particular understanding or views of academic staff at Warwick. But he described the bill as a sledgehammer to crack a nut. He said the government are fooling no one. this legislation will facilitate the likes of David Irving, Nick Griffin and others to spew out their anti-Semitic hate on our campuses. What we have before us would be more aptly titled the Hate Speech Protection Bill, a piece of legislation that would protect anti-Semites, Holocaust deniers and people whose only aim is to cause deep hurt and offence. He said that the bill is motivated by the cancellation on university campuses of just 6 scheduled events in 2020, and he says the existing legislative framework is perfectly adequate. He quotes David Davis, the Tory MP, as saying it's McCarthyism against our university sector, and that the bill will, as Ken was saying, perversely have the reverse effect in numerous unintended consequences. He then wrongly quotes Donald Rumsfeld suggesting about intended unintended consequences. Of course, Donald referred to known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown known unknowns. Anyway, but that, so the central that's the argument that was being put forward there. That it's just completely unnecessary and designed to sort of enable extreme sort of anti-Semitism, Holocaust deniers. No mention, of course, back in 2021 of your report, which had just come out, or of the problems that have arisen to do with the trans activists. What do you think?
There's a lot there. I mean, first of all, in response to Ken's question about whether or not there'll be unintended consequences by way of a sort of reverse chilling effect. Yes, I think it's possible for students' unions that they will become less activist, which isn't necessarily a good thing because a students' union is there to, you know, be political in many ways. I think that's something which will have to be kept under review. I'm hopeful that it won't have that effect, and it will just require them to be a little bit more careful, and it will open a space for students who are in the union and who might not completely sign up to the prevailing orthodoxy to request that they can be represented by the students' union as well. I don't think it is likely to have that chilling effect on university governing bodies. Yeah. I think, you know, anyone who's ever tried to control academics knows about herding cats, you know. I mean,
very true.
They'll do
very true.
Yeah, I don't think they'll be frightened of it. My experience is actually that the leadership, university leadership, in general, is very committed to academic freedom. Academic freedom is an article of faith. But they have felt that they don't have the tools to import it and to implement it, and they don't understand the law has been so complex up till now. But just on that quote that Tim, that you read out from the Labour MP, just to be absolutely clear, the Act itself only protects free speech within the law, which, I mean, we could get into a sort of complex discussion about how the law works in this respect and the differences between the Act and international instruments and so on. But bottom line is, whether under this Act or under the European Convention on Human Rights or any other piece of law, Holocaust denial is not protected speech. It falls within Article 17 of the Convention, which means it is entirely unprotected, as is almost anything that you could describe as racism. So that's, you know, it's just not right.
I wasn't quoting him because I agree with him.
I was
quoting him as an example of a somewhat hyperbolic analysis. Yeah.
I mean, the difficulty to my mind is that universities will have to work out what's lawful speech and what isn't lawful speech. And that is very, very difficult.
Yeah, well, in my opinion, there's too much unlawful speech. But I note your concession, Acra, that this bill, this act might have a chilling effect on student unions, and I think that's highly undesirable if it's the case. The other particularly controversial provision was the tort, and some of us felt that this was particularly dangerous. Whenever there was a free speech issue at the time that I was working in a university, it wasn't long before outside actors, third parties, were circling around, trying to cause trouble, including sometimes US religious bodies and organisations. And these are precisely the sorts of people who might become involved in funding tort claims against universities if they want to cause trouble around issues, pro-life issues or whatever. And I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned that this tort is a process that could be used by external actors, malevolent actors, to try and damage our universities and trying to damage discourse that they disapprove of in our universities. I mean, do you think that's a wild fear on my part, or do you think it has a real basis?
I mean, you know, wherever there's legislation, there's possibility of litigation. You know, and universities, I think, have broad enough shoulders to be able to cope with it. And it's important that the final compromise was made that the complaints scheme had to be exhausted before a tort could be pursued.
One of the things that emerges from your report is the apparent failure at Essex, I think, and maybe more generally you've seen, to actually take any steps to enforce disciplinary action against students or staff who, in the case of what happened at Essex, issued violent threats, threatened to use violence to barricade the room which was set aside, and even threatening, I think, the safety of the speaker herself. And there were similar threats, I think, against Professor Kathleen Stock at Sussex at times. And so it may be said, I don't know whether you agree with this, that the reason that there's a need for the statutory tort, which exposes student unions and universities to a financial penalty, is because they've failed to take any proper steps to enforce the current duties.
Well, precisely right. I mean, the director of free speech will be able to make a recommendation that universities pay some compensation, but it's not binding. I mean, I'm sure that universities will pay it. Students' unions might not. And it really is a backstop, I think, the tort. But I think it's important that it's there.
In your report, Akira, you reference the University of Oxford freedom of speech policy, which you very kindly seem to suggest is a paradigm. And I say kindly because I drafted it along with...
Oh, brilliant. Thank you. Thank God I said that.
Yeah. along with historian Timothy Garden-Ash. I just want to read it. It's very short. It's deliberately short, actually. And it says this: free speech is the lifeblood of a university. It enables the pursuit of knowledge. It helps us approach truth. It allows students, teachers and researchers to become better acquainted with the variety of beliefs, theories and opinions in the world. Recognising the vital importance of free expression for the life of the mind, a university may make rules concerning the conduct of debate, but should never prevent speech that is lawful. Inevitably, this will mean that members of the university are confronted with views that some will find unsettling, extreme, or offensive. The university must therefore foster freedom of expression within a framework of robust civility. Not all theories deserve equal respect. A university values expertise and intellectual achievement as well as openness. But within the bounds set by law, all voices or views which any member of our community considers relevant should be given the chance of a hearing. Wherever possible, they should also be exposed to evidence, questioning and argument. As an integral part of this commitment to freedom of expression, we will take steps to ensure that all exchanges happen peacefully, with appropriate regulation of the time, place and manner of events. Neither speakers nor listeners should have any reasonable grounds to feel intimidated or censored. I mean, if universities all lived up to that sort of statement, there would be no need for legislation.
Well, right, but they have real difficulty in doing that. There are quite a number of issues that play into that. I mean, one of them, in my view, is the fact that universities now have customers. They are trying to make themselves attractive to their customers, i.e. their students, by having all sorts of charter marks and accreditation scores and so forth, which means that they are then taking advice from and trying to impress charter mark organisations who will give them a bauble. And those people have single interests.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about policies is exactly, you know, one can have the most brilliant policy. And of course, the Essex University were quoted in your report. You quoted Essex University as having a no platforming policy that had wide support, and that the policy of the university was to ensure that members do not obstruct or interfere with the rights of others to express views with which they might disagree profoundly. So, of course, not quite as eloquent, perhaps, as Ken's drafted policy at Oxford, Ken and Tim Garton-Ash, but the same sort of principle is there. But obviously, in your analysis, it just wasn't being enforced or upheld.
No, and what universities really have difficulty with is their equality, diversity, and inclusion strategies and policies on the one hand, and their freedom of speech and academic freedom policies on the other. My view is these are all part of one whole, single whole. But they need to be understood because the Equality Act itself protects freedom of speech under the protected characteristic of philosophical belief. So it's all part of a whole, and people and universities need to stop seeing them as being opposed to each other in the way that they do. But the problem has become political in the sense that for some extraordinary reason, freedom of speech is now seen as a right-wing dog whistle. I don't know how we got to this point. I find it absolutely extraordinary, but we did. And it's seen as the enemy of inclusion. And that is where universities, in my experience, fall down, is they don't understand how to marry those two. And they don't understand how to clarify in their own minds and in their policies that these are all part of one system. You can't have inclusion and equality and diversity if you don't have inclusion of people with different ideas who want to say different things.
Yeah, well, some years ago, I saw the Dean of Yale Law School give a lecture in which he was positing free expression as a tool of oppression and a tool of oppressors employed to keep those without power in their place. And that's a profoundly depressing analysis. Akra, before we finish, I want to raise an issue which you may or may not be able to comment on, since you are a commissioner of the Equality and Human Rights Commission. It's a report in yesterday's Times, apparently leaked by someone, and no doubt leaked malevolently, that the chair of the commission, Baroness Kishwa Faulkner, is under investigation following complaints by present and former commissioners. And a hint that some of this may be motivated by the stand that she's taken on some of the issues that we are discussing today, particularly her stand on transgender issues and women's rights. A very measured stand, so far as I've been able to discern it. I must say, I hope that's not true. If it is true, it's extraordinarily serious. And I think this is something that we need to watch very, very carefully as it progresses. Are you able to give any insight into this?
Well, the first thing I will say is that I'm here not in my capacity as a commissioner. So nothing I have said today should be understood as me talking in my capacity as a commissioner at the EHRC. I can't comment specifically on what's been reported by Channel 4 News. There's a statement on the commission's website from Martial Bou, the chief executive, which gives the position of the commission on that matter. I will say it would be a real shame if the investigation which has been reported were to be jeopardised in its fairness by the fact that there have been leaks. That's what I will say. And I will also say on the underlying issue that the commission, the board of commissioners, pays very, very careful attention to internal and external challenge on the matters relating to sex and gender on which we've taken decisions in the last year or two. And we face very substantial challenge. We have to balance the rights of all nine protected people who come within all nine protected characteristics.
And we
have to recognise the fact that the Equality Act provides rights against the right not to be discriminated against because you have the female sex or the male sex, and that needs to be reflected in the law, as well as the right not to be discriminated against because you have the protected characteristic of gender reassignment. And we're very committed to that. And nothing that we have done, undermines that protection. There has been an extraordinary and outrageous amount of misinformation about the extent to which, in particular, the letter that was written by Kishwa on behalf of the board to Kemi Badenoch allegedly undermines trans rights. It doesn't go anywhere near the recommendation that was made to consider clarifying that the word sex in the Equality Act means biological sex would not have, if that change was made by government, that would not have the consequences for trans people's rights that have been irresponsibly reported by quite a number of organisations and individuals. It wouldn't have one-tenth of those consequences. The only consequence that it would have is that some people with GRC, some complaints by people with gender recognition certificates, only those people would be have to be brought differently under the Equality Act than they currently are. But the idea that it would mean that trans people can't go out into the street and enjoy their lives in dignity and peace is an irresponsible lie.
It's outrageous. It's absolutely outrageous. And we've seen in other organisations that leaderships have been targeted if they've failed a purity test on these issues. And I repeat, we need to watch this very, very carefully to ensure that it doesn't happen in all places, the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Aqua, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure. It's been fascinating. Thank you.
Marvellous. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much, Aqua. You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with Ken MacDonald and with me, Tim Owen. If you've enjoyed this episode, please visit our back catalogue. There we now have 31 episodes to entertain you. And of course, if you've enjoyed it and really, really enjoyed it, then give us a 5-star review. That helps other people to find us on the various podcasting platforms. We'll be back with you in a couple of weeks and look forward to seeing you then. Our editor is Billy Lawrence and our social media advisor is Jess Jones.